And welcome to 6 Degrees from the City, a podcast about writing and Western Sydney. I'm your host, Fiona Wright, and I'm delighted to be talking in this episode to Oliver Pomeran. Oliver is a children's author and stand-up comedian who has written 7 books, including Tyrific, which was named an honour book in the Koala Awards, Con Nerd, which is a Children's Book Council of Australia notable book, and most recently, Super Con Nerd and the Other Christie. Oliver lives in Cabramatta and grew up in nearby Canley Vale, where he also worked as a primary school teacher before turning to writing full-time. He joined me to talk about embarrassing families, classroom politics, and how to force down bitter melon soup. Here's Oliver reading from The Other Christie.
There's a white fluffy rabbit in our backyard. He's sitting down on the grass eyeing off Grandpa's plants. Grandpa and I are squatting behind him. Grandpa turns to me and licks his lips. We should catch him. I roll my eyes. No animal is safe from Grandpa. Rabbits, pigeons, stray cats, even our neighbor's dog Oscar would end up on a Grandpa's plate if he didn't have a collar. Grandpa's weird like that. He likes to make the most of what he can find. It came in handy when we first came to Australia with hardly anything. I quickly reach out to touch the rabbit so he hops away. I chase him all the way to the back fence. He slips through the hole. I crouch down and quietly call after him. See you tomorrow, but be careful. Grandpa shakes his head. You should stop feeding him, especially with my plants. I like him. I'm glad the rabbit keeps coming back. I don't know where he comes from or who he really belongs to, but he's the closest thing I have to a pet. Pets are another thing that Grandpa doesn't allow at our place, along with microwaves, music, and lollies. He'll end up in my cooking pot if he gets any juicier, Grandpa laughs. That's just wrong, I say. Yes, maybe we should barbecue him instead. We both laugh. Then I have a thought. Barbecue? You know, that's not a bad name for him. It's still not a bad idea either. Grandpa strapped on his gloves. Come on, Christy, we have housework today. I groan. We have housework every day. The house isn't going to clean itself. I wish it did. But even if we had robots cleaning the house, Grandpa would still be scrubbing away behind them. He'll probably wash the robots as well. I like being inside a clean house too, but I wish we didn't have to do so much housework. I grab the broom and the dustpan and the brush, sweeping through the house. We live in a small place, but it still takes us ages because Grandpa wants me to do every room twice. Then he makes me mop the floor until I can see my bored self in those glossy tiles. It gets pretty lonely here sometimes. My grandpa has always been around, but my dad left before I was born. So for a while, it was just Mum and Grandpa looking after me in Cambodia. We were planning to come to Australia to live with Auntie Mei Lee, but then Mum got really sick and passed away when I was 4. It took Grandpa a while to build up the courage to move on, but we finally landed in Australia 5 years later. I was happy to be here, but even happier to see my Auntie Mei Lee again. We all lived together for a few months, but Grandpa was driving her crazy with his cleaning habits. Luckily, someone from Auntie Mei Lee's church found Grandpa and me a small place around the corner. He was happy to move out. I'm only 6 to 7 years old. I could look after myself and Christy, he told them. I didn't want to leave Auntie Mei Lee, but I couldn't leave Grandpa alone either. He needs me too. By the time I finish my chores, I'm ready for a shower. I take off my gloves. Why can't you clean when I'm at school, I say. Like, what do you do all day, Grandpa? I'm buying food for dinner, Grandpa says. You should be doing that with me, I say. All you've been buying is carrots. We've been having carrots all month, like carrot soup, steamed carrots, stir-fried carrots. I hope my skin doesn't turn orange because he might throw me in the pot too. When Grandpa likes a type of food, he eats it to death, and it's usually cheaper by the sack. Sometimes he buys other vegetables at the Asian grocery store, like bok choy or Chinese broccoli or bitter melon. It all tastes the same to me. Disgusting. He loves making bitter melon soup for me. I think he does it just to see my lips turn inside out. I finish all my chores and sneak into the kitchen. I fill a bowl with water, then pour 3 spoons of sugar into the bowl, stirring it around until the sugar dissolves. And then I put the bowl on the table and lick it like a cat drinking milk. Yeah, I'm weird too. I must have learned it from Grandpa.
I'm so glad
so glad that you read From the Other Christie, because I really loved that book.
Yeah, same. You know, it's kind of funny. I was so hesitant to write a book from a girl's perspective. And then I finally made the leap. And now, you know, my next three books I'm actually working on, including a sequel to The Other Christie, are all girl books, which is fantastic. So, yeah.
Yeah. I loved it because it's so clever. I mean, even from the title, you know, the other Christie, that kind of has that alterity sort of built into it, and who is othered in the story is something that's constantly shifting.
Yeah, that's right. And the sequel is going to be called Another Christie. So it's going to be another Christie into the mix, and so the sort of dynamics will change as well. So I'm looking forward to reading that. So I'm looking forward to writing that as well.
Yeah. So in this first one, the other Christie.
Yeah.
You know, you just introduced us to Christie number one.
Yes. Who's
the other Christie at the start of the book.
Mm.
But the other Christie is sort of the fancy rich white girl.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So she's very popular. She's very loud. You know, she's always the girl that always distracts the class. And so the teacher naturally says, Christie, stop doing that. And so when we talk about Christie in the class, we're talking about that Christie, not the other Christie, the one who never makes a noise, never makes a fuss kind of thing. So,
I love the kind of the politicking of that.
Yeah, yeah. I love writing about classroom politics, I guess. That's one of the things I really enjoyed as a teacher, was being in the coalface and seeing, you know, 30 different personalities in a class, and, you know, they're not all going to be friends. There's going to be some rifts and some arguments and some tension among them. And so this is kind of loosely based on a story where I went to a school and these two girls named Sarah were both best friends, but they had different spellings. And so I wondered about, you know, what if these two girls in my class became best friends over the course of a year, and what would sort of cause them to become best friends. So,
And, of course, I loved that one of the things that helps them become best friends is baking.
Yeah, yeah.
While I was reading the book, I did have to stop and bake twice.
Oh, really? Okay, cool. That's not the first time I've heard that, actually. Right. Like, it's really, because my wife, she loves to bake.
Yeah.
And so I've sort of become like the Christie to the Auntie Mei Lee, who's the expert baker here. And so I'm helping her out and doing all these things. And yeah, it's wonderful. I'm a big baker as well. Well, when I say big baker, I mean like baker's assistant, actually, because I just help her eat it and clean up afterwards. So
I call it procrastibaking.
Ah, nice. Okay, yeah. That's actually, you know what, that's actually a productive one, actually, because at least you get to eat something afterwards.
And I mean, the joke I always make is that I feel like it's the exact opposite of writing in a way, because when you are baking something, you've got a recipe and you just
You
know what to put in, more quantities, and what to do, and you're guaranteed to get something at the end.
Yeah.
Or I feel like often when you're writing, you know you're making something, you don't know what it is.
Yeah.
Not 100% sure what the ingredients are.
Yeah.
You just kind of like chuck stuff in a bowl and hope that it.
Yeah, that's right. And you can't Google it up to see if you're doing it right or not as well. So I know how you feel. I've had days like that as well, actually. So, yeah.
I did want to ask you about your background as a primary school teacher.
Yeah.
So how long did you do that for?
I taught full-time for 1 year.
Yep.
And the reason behind that was because I did my Bachelor of Communication Writing and Publishing at University of Western Sydney. And I found out one thing, and the one thing I've learned from that degree was that there's no guarantee of success of being a writer.
Mm.
So I needed a backup, and so I was leaning towards doing like a dip ed.
Yeah.
And I was going to be a high school teacher. And then I thought, you know what, I might get bashed. So being in a high school, in a rough sort of school out in the suburbs, I realized that I'm going to do primary school teaching because at least I'm bigger than most of the kids. And so I did that, and I just ended up loving it. I fell into it so deeply. And I think that gave me the courage to actually have a backup job. It gave me the courage to actually pursue writing because I had a backup job now. And so I after 1 year, I just quit. And my principal was kind of devastated. Like, why would you quit after 1 year? And I thought, well, I really wanted to give writing a go. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to sort of let it go. And the plan was always going to be, you know, part-time teacher to pay the bills and all the admin stuff. And then writing was going to be my main passion.
Yeah.
But I guess I was very thankful, actually, that I did do teaching because to that point, I wanted to write for adults.
Yeah.
And so a lot of my writing in university was very dark. It was very satire. And I did stand-up comedy back then as well. A lot of stand-up comedy. So it was kind of like borderline of like, you know, wanting to write a sitcom or a show kind of thing. And then it was until I became a primary school teacher that I realized, you know, maybe I should write for kids because I'm still a big kid myself. Maybe I should give that a go. And I haven't looked back since then. So
That's amazing. I spoke to Felicity Castagna a few episodes ago. And, you know, she was a teacher
time too. Yeah.
And I've always thought, you know, she writes young men so well because she spent so long in a boys' school. And I wonder if that experience too kind of gave you insight into how kids speak.
Yeah. I mean, that's probably the only thing I miss about teaching. Like, I don't miss the reports, the assessments, the meetings, but I miss being in the coalface of kids who don't have a filter. They're very raw.
Yeah.
They'll say what they want and they'll crush you, but at other times, you know, they're being frank and honest. And so, yeah, so that's the one thing I sort of picked up on of observing kids as a teacher and all. So I think that did actually give me the confidence to actually be able to write from a girl's perspective in that way. So, yeah.
It's so interesting. And I think, too, the other thing that I found fascinating about that is that so many of your characters are the weird kids.
Yeah.
Like especially the nerds.
Yeah.
But, you know, the outcasts, lonely. In the other Christy kind of has these drifters in the playground who she goes along and consoles and gives treats to.
Yeah.
And I was wondering about that interest, if there's something that's about those sorts of characters that just lend themselves to narrative or...
Yeah. I mean, for me, I always wanted to be the voice for the weird kids, I guess, because I was weird myself.
Same here, brother.
yeah, exactly. You know, I was never the popular kid. I mean, sure, people knew who I was, but they thought I was annoying. They thought I was just a class clown who was amusing for, like, the classroom time, but no one actually wanted to be my friend, per se. Mm. And so, you know, that feeling of wanting to belong, not even being part of the cool kids, but even I would settle for, like, you know, the C team or, like, you know, even the D team, like, you know. Yeah, I don't have to be ultra cool. Just 25% cool, I would have settled for. But you know, it's kind of funny because I always wanted to write books for the kids who did feel left out of field because I find that if you know, I'm still gonna hit kids in general anyway. But yeah. I really want to especially sort of have a voice for those kids who think they're weird, think they're strange, and there's always gonna be kids like that. You know, there's a tendency sometimes for a classroom to sort of socially rank themselves and they know who's sort of popular, who's not so popular, and which kids to pick on, which kids to not pick on and all that kind of stuff. And I wanted to sort of be that, so from the other end and talking about those kids who think they're weird, but at the end of the day, like I always say that, you know, just you know, as cliche as it sounds, but you know, if you be yourself, you would draw other people towards you for yourself. And naturally I did have friends, but they were all weird just like me, which is perfect. So
it's funny you should say that. I was just thinking is that the way I experienced weird kidness, I didn't have a sense. I thought it was something that was unique to me, and it wasn't until I was adult that I was like, oh my God, here are all the other weird kids.
Yeah.
Let's make a weird kid tribe.
Yeah, yeah. And so
I really love the idea of, you know, the kids kind of going, oh, there are others.
Yeah.
And especially that, you know, I think in the other Christy, she spends a lot of time in the library, and that was definitely my experience too.
Same here. The library was my sanctuary, was my domain.
Right.
And I still remember the library was closed for repairs for like a week or something.
Oh, God.
And it was like being out in the, like, the wastelands of like Mad Max, and you sort of skirting by the fence with a stick along the soccer field, and it's like, well, you know. So that was pretty tough. But I know how you feel. Like, you know, it's because I think kids, I don't think they want a whole lot of friends. They just want one or two friends. That's all they need. Like a couple of friends that they can sort of cling on to. And that was me in a nutshell, I think. So if those kids were away, it was a very long day. So
I wanted to ask you a little bit about it's kind of a broader question about young adult writing and children's writing.
Yeah.
It's something I've only read in the last year or so for various projects. I was also a precocious little shit. And, you know, I wanted to read stuff way above my level because I'm smart and cool.
Oh, yeah.
But the big revelation to me has been how progressive and how political they are as a form. And I find that so exciting.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, like, you know, maybe this happened, like, you know, decades ago, but it used to be a point of, like, you know, talking down to kids and, you know, here's the lesson, kids, be good, all this kind of stuff. But, you know, in this day and age, the kids probably know more about stuff than you do these days, being so savvy and all. And so, you know, there's no need to sort of shelter. I mean, I think 99% of the things you can talk about in kids' books, why, if it's done in, like, a tactful kind of matter, I think anything sort of up for grabs are fine. And, yeah, I'm the same. I feel that the books that are really pushing the issues and things like that are the kids and YA books, I find. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I think you do really interesting stuff with class in The Other Christie and with race, obviously, and a whole bunch of stuff about trauma as well and intergenerational trauma. But it's handled so lightly. I found that so impressive.
Yeah, I think for me, when I first started writing, I wanted to be out there, wacky, out there, sort of like funny for the sake of funny. But, you know, one of my biggest influences is Moses Glatzman, you know, he tackles all these issues like war and you know, even refugees and things like that. But he does it in a way where it is definitely an overarching issue and theme, but it's always taught from the kid's point of view.
Yeah.
And sometimes from the kid's point of view, the issues themselves are not as major as something like that. It's actually a bit more closer than that. And so for me, I really wanted to sort of have that sort of become the forefront. So,
it feels like it's very much the fabric of their lives and it's the thing that they it's so normalized.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, and of course there's a lovely scene in The Other Christie where White Christie, I'm going to call her White Christie.
Yeah. I realised that I've actually realised that I can't actually have this as an audiobook because it would just be impossible. Yeah, I know how you feel. So
So White Christie comes over to visit Main Christie, and kind of all of those kind of unspoken mores of the household are suddenly very present in Christie's mind, like taking the shoes off and dealing with beer melon soup.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. And it's funny, isn't it? Because, you know, you can control your family's weirdness or their habits and their traditions in a tight space, but as soon as an outsider comes along, it just sort of like it becomes a highlight there, and all of a sudden you have all this anxiety about, oh, please, family, just be normal, you know.
Yeah.
I remember my dad. I was in high school, and my dad, when we were just 15, 16, it just comes out and goes, "Hey, do you want a beer?" And I'm like, that's like the worst thing you could ever say. And thankfully, none of my friends said no.
Oh, my friends would have loved that.
Yeah. But, you know, for my dad, because he basically worked, and he still works as a labourer out there for, like, you know, that's what the thing you do. You know, you go out, you have drinks and all that kind of stuff, so.
Yeah, that's interesting. So your dad works as a
labourer? Yeah. So he works at a, he does like door frames sort of thing. So yeah, at a factory. So yeah, so still working. And it's just one of the things that he would just pick up, you know, like his love of rugby league, his sort of came through his workmates back then. So yeah.
And do you ever have that weird thing with them having such a different job? Yeah.
Oh, right.
This is something I'm fascinated
weird
by.
Weird as in, like, what do you mean, like?
Oh, I'm just fascinated by writers and their families at the moment. You know, I have, like, writer friends who've come from creative families, and it's always kind of like, oh,
okay,
that's cool, that's fine, whatever. And then I know writer friends whose parents do, and everyone else in the family have very sensible, important, quote-unquote, real jobs. And that kind of... They're kind of like, I don't know what it is that you do on a day-to-day basis kind of thing.
Oh, right, yeah. Yeah, you know, because, you know, in Conrad, his mum wanted him to be a doctor, and that was for me as well.
Yeah, right.
My mum wanted me to be a doctor
as
well, and it wasn't a doctor, it was an accountant or some sort of, like, job with high status, just so mum could say, oh, look at Oliver, he's an accountant or a lawyer or something like that. And so... When I said I wanted to be a writer, they were kind of shocked, because I still remember my mum said, "Oh, you want to be a writer? So when does the book come out?" I'm like, "Well, I haven't got a publishing deal yet." Like, how come? And I'm like, "Well, because you know, it's hard to get a book deal, this kind of stuff." And you know, I think for them, like even so, I had to say that I wanted to be a journalist, just so they could sort of kind of picture what it was. But even then, I realized that journalists, in terms of like Asian jobs. So jobs that Asian people look at, journalists would be right in the, like, you know, I think just below like car sales men or something, right. You know, like not something
just as trustworthy.
Exactly, that's right. So not as classy as doctor or lawyer. So, and even then, I also wanted to be a stand-up comedian as well, and that was something that was completely foreign to them as well. There's actually no word for stand-up comedian in Thai.
Yeah,
like the closest word would be clown, and so. My mum didn't want to say, yeah, Oliver wants to go to clown. He's going to clown college, all that kind of stuff. And so I picked jobs that were, like, not only were they unconventional, but they were also in a sense where, like, I guess growing up, like, there wasn't really anyone out there that had already sort of, like, there weren't any trailblazers out there yet, if that makes sense. Like, you know, when I was doing research for Terrific, wanting to get a book deal, and I was looking for, like, Asian Australian characters out there, and there were hardly any. Like, they were just, you know. And so it was quite lacking. So,
I think you're about the same age as me, and Looking for Ella Brandy was published while I was in high school, and that was the revelation.
Yeah,
that there were migrant characters.
Yeah.
In that, and even then, that was like the 90s, which is a good 40 years since like the big waves of Italian Greek migration.
Yeah, that's right.
Such a delay.
Yeah. And I'm really so glad to actually hear that sort of like voice sort of come out, because it means that you know, we are starting to see all these voices sort of come out of the woodwork. And I think it's a lot quicker these days than just like 4 decades now. Like, thankfully, we're getting a lot of like different voices out there, which is really good.
And I think it's happening in stand up at the same time.
Yeah,
too, right?
in a big way as well. The I guess in the arts world, it's kind of really. In the creative arts space, that's when you are getting to see that major diversity of voices coming out, and also
You know, it's exciting to me to see this sort of stuff in young adult writing and children's writing, because I feel like that's makes a normal world that you then grow into.
Right, and I think like I really do get a kick of visiting schools where the kids are Asian, and they do look at me and they go, it can be done. Like, if I wanted to be a writer or an artist or a singer, like, there are people out there that I can sort of earmark and go, okay, I want to be like just like them and like them. And so, so it's really cool. Like, it's something that I never take for granted. I think it's something that really makes it sort of worthwhile for me. And I'm going shopping with Mama in Cabramatta. She's got a list of things for our Chinese New Year celebrations. John Street is a sea of red streamers and lanterns. Every store has their flowers at the front. Mama checks them out like they're puppies in a dog pound. She's very picky about our flowers. If they bloom on Chinese New Year, then we'll have a year of good luck. We choose an array of red and orange dandelion that look much tougher than Tori's Valentine's Day rose. There are dragon dances happening down the street. I can hear the drums and chants before I see the dragon's head bopping up and down. I love how the dancers make the dragon move like a flying serpent. They give me ideas for my own dragons in Fireproof Nights. Mama ducks into a shop to get some orange and tangerines. She buys a tray filled with different types of dried fruit for our family reunion for Chinese New Year. We go all out for Dad's offering, serving him a banquet. I'll get the duck and chicken on another night, she says. My arms are glad to hear that. I'm struggling to carry the flowers in this crowd. We meet up with Mrs. Choi and Mrs. Nguyen at the cafe at the end of John Street. We're in the middle of another game of My Kid is Better Than Yours. Asian parents play it all the time. This is where my family's honor gets tested, because Mama has to sell me like I'm the best fish at the markets. Hannah's OC class is already doing year 7 work. Mr. Choi turns to me. You need to get a head start for high school next year. I cough and splutter out some iced bubble tea. Hannah's got so much of a head start, she'll soon be lapping the other kids. Mrs. Newman's smile is a half-moon half moon across her face. Ryan's working at a year 8 level, she says through her smirk. He's rehearsing for the Western Sydney Orchestra. They're playing at the Opera House next month. Yes, Mama says. I saw his picture in the paper. It's the fourth time he's made the paper. When he came second in the New South Wales spelling bee, he made it onto page 3. Mama almost fainted from shock. I nearly puked. She sticks up his articles on the fridge door. Now I see his face every time I want a drink. Mama loves collecting newspaper articles about freaky nerds. Like there's this one about a 14-year-old kid who's going to Sydney Uni, or the 15-year-old doctor in Singapore. I get it. Mama's trying to motivate me, but all I know is that there are a million kids who are smarter and more successful than me. Mama loses this game all the time. Like when I got a distinction in the maths competition, Hannah and Ryan had high distinctions. If I got like a principal's award for Mr. Ruby, Ryan would get like a medallion from some politician. If I got like 20 out of 20 in a spelling test, Hannah would get like 100 out of 20. Like they make my awards on the walls look like a stamp collection. Mama starts getting a twitch in her eye. It's her turn now, but she just plays with a spoon, listening to Mrs. Choi and Mrs. Nguyen yak on about their Nobel Prize winners in the future. It's up to me to score a few goals for the Wong family, and I know a couple of comebacks. A. Oh yeah? Well, Connor's working on his own manga comic, and then he's going to be a famous artist. B. Connor's playing basketball with two of the best players in Greenhill Public School. He's going to be a part of the championship winning team. C. Connor is going to go out with Tori. If there was a beauty competition, she would get like a super high distinction. Or D. All above. A triple hit combo. But I can't tell her any of that because it hasn't happened yet. But if I'm going to make Mama and my family proud, I've got to do something really special.
I wanted to ask you a bit about the wacky families.
Oh, yes.
In your book.
Yeah.
I love them. You know, the families are all slightly mad.
Yeah.
And they do come with certain expectations of their children too. I think we heard that in both of those pieces.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yeah.
One of the things I always say to kids in my workshops is to write about your life, you know, write about your family, your friends. And your family has a wealth of ideas for stories, whether it's like the embarrassing kind or the crazy kind or just the weird things that your family does out in public that are quite cringeworthy for the kids themselves. Yeah. And so, yeah, like, you know, it's something that I love writing about because it's a very universal thing. Like, I would say that, you know, Terrific, basically what it comes down to is about embarrassing families. And I've asked that question, who has an embarrassing family all around the world? And everyone puts their hand up because it's such a universal mark. We all have families and we all wish, I mean, we love them.
Yeah.
But, you know, sometimes, you know, they really push you to the edge or they push your buttons and you just have to sort of, you know, like hang your head sometimes and realize what are you doing kind of thing. But then the best thing about it is that when you get older, you become that embarrassing family. So it's a circle of life that happens over and over again. So it's something that can't be stopped, you know. So
that's great. As a kid within a family too, you're in that weird position where you kind of don't have any power in a way.
Yeah.
And a lot of the time they're trying to figure out your own world and your own sense of self within that context.
Yeah, that's right. I think, you know, especially for Lingy in Terrific, you know, he wants to be Australian, you know, and I wanted to be Australian too when I was a kid. But I didn't know what that looked like, you know. Like, you know, does it mean you got to play cricket or play rugby league or... And, you know, sometimes I do ask kids when I visit schools, or, you know, are you Australian? And they go, oh, no, well, I'm Chinese or I'm Vietnamese. Even though there are, by this stage, they're like second or third generations now. So they're born here, their parents are born here now, and they're still saying they don't feel Australian. So it's kind of weird sometimes. I don't know. I think it's this sense of, like, you know, wanting to belong in the family space, but also wanting to have your own identity outside the family as well. And I think, you know, that's when you kind of figure out those questions when you're a teenager or when you're a kid. So,
and migration often has complicated things.
Yes, that's right. Yeah,
for these guys, because the context that they're growing up in is so different from what their parents are used to.
Yeah,
like linguistically, culturally.
Yeah, that's right. So the parents are also trying to etch their own identities as well, because they are. thrown into a different world as well. Mm. So they're trying to find their own identity and at the same time with these kids as well. And so I understand it. Like, you know, my mum and dad used to want me to speak Thai all the time. They forced me to go to, like, language school, and they forced me to eat Thai food even though I wanted to have McDonald's or KFC or stuff like that. And I realised that, you know, it's not them just doing it because, it's, you know, it saves money and it's cheap. But even though those are the reasons why, but it's because it's the fact that they want to sort of still impart some of their culture onto their kids, I think. Because I think for them, it's important for them to realise that they should be proud of having, like, both cultures. And I think that's something that people eventually do sort of come to that conclusion. But sometimes as a kid, you sort of find the wrong way to actually get there. So,
yeah. You don't want to stand out in any way.
Yeah, that's right. And plus, you know, and as a kid, as a teen, you want to rebel against your family anyway. Yeah. So, you know, it's kind of like, and sometimes that means, like, you know, forgoing the culture. That means, like, oh, you know, I'm a stoner. I don't have to do this anymore. I don't have to dress up to go to a Thai temple anymore. Or do I have to go to a Thai temple? Like, you know, I'm too old for that now. You know, that's you know, all that kind of stuff. And you realize that it's not just a family thing. It's much deeper than that.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
You just don't realize when you're a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so interesting.
Hmm.
I wanted to ask you, picking up on what you said about food.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like that's a really common expression, both of family and of difference that comes up in the books.
Yeah.
Again and again. I mean, in Thai Rific, the family owns a Thai restaurant.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. And I guess for me, it's the fact that, you know, because, I mean, you know, not only does food bring people together, but it also is a great introduction into someone's culture and someone's family life, you know? Like, it's, you come over for a meal and you get to see, you know, their home cooking and what it's like. And, you know, it's kind of funny because I haven't realized this, but food is actually a major theme of some of my books over there. And, yeah, it's kind of cool because I think it's something that the readers and the kids can relate to in that sense.
Yeah. Well, it's so concrete.
Yeah, exactly.
And so social.
Mm.
And so laden with meaning.
Yeah. Because, you know, I like to think that most kids now have tried, you know, Thai food or something similar by this station. So at least they can share some of, like, Lenny's sort of feelings when he eats a Thai food at some point. So that's really cool. So, yeah.
If they haven't had bitter melon soup.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the bitter melon soup is only for kettle fish because I would never recommend bitter melon soup to anyone.
I love bitter melon.
Are we?
Yeah. But, you know, I'm weird.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, I'll eat it as long as I keep telling myself it's good for me. And then somehow I just get through it. So, yeah.
Oh, that's great. As well as the books, you've mentioned that you do stand up, and you also make comics. Is that right?
I just do stand up comedy. Yeah.
Oh, okay, okay. So they're two very different types of writing.
Yeah, they are. You know, I originally did stand up comedy to test out my writing because you find out very quickly if something is funny or not by testing out on stage. And so for me, it was just...
God, to me, that's a terrifying way of testing out your writing.
Oh, yeah, it is. And, you know, it's so crushing. I mean, there are nights where you wonder, what am I doing with myself? And, you know, 5 minutes turns into, like, 5 hours. But, you know, at the same time, it's that instant feedback that you really crave for. And so I did stand-up comedy because of that. And even though I don't do that much stand-up comedy anymore because, you know, I'm kind of like the West Tigers. I perform better on paper. You know, I think I would rather sort of pursue writing much more than in stand-up comedy. But, you know, I still love it. You know, I love being able to surprise people with expectations, and that's what comedy is all about. It's about the element of surprise. It's about the opposite of normal. It's about sort of like flipping expectations around.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when I used to do a lot of stand-up comedy, I used to travel out to these country towns, and I would be the only Asian in the country town for like 3 days straight. Yeah. And, you know, you get up on stage and, you know, you're in a pub somewhere and everyone's looking at you and the first 10 seconds before you get to that first joke is like the longest 10 seconds of your life because you wonder, are they going to laugh at me? Are they going to throw something at me? What should I do kind of thing? But you know what? Most of the times they laugh and it becomes like a really great show. And afterwards they're very friendly and all that kind of stuff. And so sometimes it's that anxiety in your head. And I think that happens in Thai Rific, you know, this fear that you're going to be looked at for being different. But at the end of the day, they're not looking at that at all. It's just most of it's just kind of like in your head kind of thing.
Yeah. The kind of impression I have of stand-up from the margins is that so much of it is about danger too.
Yeah.
And, you know, risk in the kind of jokes that you set up.
Yeah, that's right. Because at the end of the day, you have to be vulnerable on stage. Yeah. You know, whether it's a persona or you're being yourself, you have to put yourself out there. But at the same time, you also have to be liked by the crowd as well. So if they like you, then they'll follow you anywhere. So you could say the most wackiest, out there jokes, no matter how controversial they are. If they like you, they'll laugh at you because you've won them over that much already, kind of thing. And so for me, stand-up comedy is much more than just the jokes or delivery themselves. It's about the character you put on stage as well. So... that's why I love doing these sort of like comic observations in my books, because they kind of are like stand-up routines in one sense.
Yeah,
like,
I was going to say that the books are terrifically funny.
Yeah. I mean, and that comes with, like, you know, being able to perform on stage and cutting out the words that don't work, and making sure that the punchline or the funniest line is at the end of the joke, because. You know, I find that it's actually a lot harder to make someone laugh on the page because there's no element of surprise. So you have to sort of find ways to actually do it. And I've been very thankful that I've been finding ways to sort of add the funny parts into it. So
And I notice so often you sort of like almost end a chapter with a joke.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is such a beautiful structural device and such a great way to get people going through.
That's right. So
I wanted to ask you a little bit about place.
Oh, yes, now. Yeah.
One of the things I loved, I picked this up in the other Christie that you keep talking about, Cabra Vale.
Which
really made me giggle.
Nice, yeah.
But you're in Cabramatta, right?
I am, yes. I live in Cabramatta.
Did you grow up in Cabra?
I grew up in Canny Vale, right next door to Cabramatta. So I grew up in Canny Vale.
So you're from Cabra Vale is what you're telling me.
Basically, that's right. Yeah, I've come back to my roots. I've come sort of full circle, even though it's only like a 15-kilometre radius. But I've come full circle back then. So I grew up in Canny Vale. And then in year four, when I was 9 years old, I moved with my parents to Liverpool, to Higginbrook, which is out sort of south, sort of near Heckenberg, Green Valley, Hoxton Park. And then since then, I've moved out, got married, and we're living in Cabramatta now.
And Cabra's home.
Oh yeah, Cabra's home. Yeah, I love Cabramatta. Yeah, I mean it's you know you take for granted sometimes how good it is to actually buy fresh Asian vegetables on the day and then be able to cook them. And also thankful that you don't have to find parking on the weekends because. Like, there's just not enough car park spots in Canberra. And Canberra's become, like, you know, it used to be a little bit dodgy, of course, back in the day. But these days now, it's become, like, a big foodie destination. And you have, like, tours. There's people there with the red flags going along. Oh, this is actually, like, you know, this is Mimi's restaurant here, Mimi's restaurant here. I'm like, wow, this is just, like, you know, this is just my neighbourhood. This is my backyard kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so that's quite amusing. But you do still see people sell illegal stuff these days, though. That still happens down in the forefront. Except it's not drugs anymore. It's actually just old little ladies selling off their vegetables that they've grown in their backyard. And for the longest time, the council tries to get rid of them, but, you know, they keep coming back. So now it's just, like, it doesn't matter. So you go through John Street now, and you will see old ladies, and sometimes old men too, they're just sitting outside with their, you know, with their bitter melon or with their, like, bok choy and all that kind of stuff, which is kind of cute, but it's not right for the shopkeepers, but anyway, it's all good, so, yeah.
But I love that it comes through in the writing too, like, John Street was...
Yeah, that's right.
From that section you read about it.
And it's kind of funny, because, you know, I wanted to make the point that I wanted to set these stories all in Western Sydney, you know, at the very start, because I wanted the kids in the schools in those areas to actually read and go, oh yeah, that's Liverpool, or that's Fairfield, or that's Cabramatta, and so. But then, as I kept writing the books, I realized that, you know, like once you set something in a place, you have to be really authentic to it, and. Because you're doing comedy, you don't want to make too much fun of one place, you know? You don't want to make too many jokes about Cabramatta because obviously that might come back to bite you down the track. And while I love books like, you know, The Incredible Here and Now, which you know, earmarks, you know, all these places, and I've driven past there and I've been to those places and I absolutely love it. But, you know, Felicity, that's a wonderful job of grounding that story in, and that place becomes a character almost in the story. Where for me, I'm just using it as a bit of a backdrop. So what I've done is I've sort of done sort of halfway. So what I've done is I made up suburbs like Cabra Vale.
Yeah.
Which is like, you know, a little nod to like Cabramatta and Canny Vale.
And there's Cabra Vale Heights.
And there's Cabra, yeah.
Where White Christie lives.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Which is the fancy Cabra Vale. Oh, yeah. Which is so cool. And also, you know, in the book that I'm writing now, the school is going to be called Merriford. Which is a cross between Marylands and Guildford. And nice. So if anyone out there has any like other sort of suburbs they can mash together and give to me, I'll be happy to take it. Like, you know, in my next book, Natural Born Loser, you know, the school is Barajong.
Right.
And that's obviously a nice little nod to like Wanneroo kind of thing as well. So, you know, also I think that's probably what I do, I think. Because I imagine that, you know, my experiences in Western Sydney would exactly be the same for kids who live in the outer suburbs of, like, say, Perth, Brisbane, yeah, Melbourne, yeah. And so on. So I want to make sure that those kids could read it and go and still get the same kind of thing as well.
Yeah, but I think that touches on something that's really important about that sort of place writing, that when you do recognise your city or your part of the city.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's such a wonderful reading experience.
Oh, it is, yeah, yeah. And, you know, I've had kids come up to me with Connor and they say it's her favourite book because they've been to those places because of that, which is so cool. So I do appreciate that as well. So I'm really thankful that I've been able to actually put those places in my early books just so to say that I've done it. So,
I sometimes think it must be, like, imagine being, you know, someone from New York and just seeing your world everywhere all the time. And
that was
how things are for everyone.
And yeah.
It's such a fascinating thing when you suddenly realise, too, the absence of your place in these, you know, in books in general, because reading it is such a startling thing.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah. And I guess, you know, on one hand you want to have it in a way where everyone can kind of read it and get different things out of it and so by not naming a place or having a fake place, people can throw their own perspectives of their own place into that place.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you can't ignore the impact of actually naming a place and actually putting it into a story. So,
but yeah. I do think even when you do have, you know, Canny Vale and Barunga, you know, those places are still recognisably Western Sydney.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. So, yeah.
And that has to do with, you know, like the cultural makeup and the sense of scale.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the buildings.
Yeah.
You know.
That's true as well, because, like, there are little things like, you know, like going to the shops is just that arcade strip of shops. And so, like, little touches like that I'll still put into my stories, because in a sense I still want to always set my stories out there in the suburbs kind of area.
For that normalizing, or?
I think only because it's a little bit of that, but also because it's what I know as well. In that sense, I couldn't imagine myself writing the story. But you know what? Never say never, though. Of course, I think, like, you know, as soon as I pigeonhole myself into one thing, I don't want to think that that's all I can write, kind of thing. But at this stage, I'm happy writing stories out there because. Mainly because there's not many stories out there in the first place.
Yeah.
And so I want to keep filling that hole kind of thing. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm.
And I was thinking too when you were reading from Connor that there's something kind of wonderful that happens when you have all those mothers sitting around.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Talking about their children.
Yeah.
And the big achievements are things like being in the Western Sydney Orchestra. The Green Hills basketball team.
Yeah.
It's both, like, super sweet and kind of incongruous
I
think that's really cheeky.
Yeah, it is. And I think, you know, it's a very passive aggressive kind of game, actually. Like, you know, that mothers play or parents play in general, I guess, in that sense. And, you know, that feeling of never feeling good enough for my parents, because they did force me to go to tutoring, and I was. You know, doing 2-3 hours of, like, algebra work, advanced year 9 integration when I'm in, like, year 6, because you can for some reason, I don't know why. I respect people who do maths and they're really good at it, but I knew that I wasn't ever going to be smart enough to do maths or science or anything related to that.
Yeah.
So, and I think my mom and dad realized that by the time I hit year 10, and so I think from that they kind of dropped off, which, I guess it was kind of good in a way, but also it kind of, I felt sad in a way as well, because that means that they realized that I was not kind of to be a doctor or anything like that. So I guess, you know, and it's another cliche, but, you know, one of my hopes of wanting to be a writer was to actually show my mum and dad that I could pursue something that I really, really wanted to do and make them proud of me kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so that determination sort of helped me as well, I think. So,
I think there's probably a ton of young people who are pretty happy that you're not a doctor.
Yeah. Especially though, there's people who lots of actually saved, actually, for not being a doctor, I think, because I'm scared of needles, so I would have probably fainted. I probably would have fainted before I put anything into someone anyway, so that's all right.
I like that. You've kind of got a constitutional inability to do this job in the first place.
Yeah, exactly. That's right.
Oh, that's good. What are you working on at the moment?
So I'm working on, I've just put the finishing touches to Natural Born Loser.
Yeah.
Which is about a boy who, you know, goes to a very rough school. You know, they've had principals come in and come out every single year kind of thing. And this new principal comes in and says, you know what? I'm going to lay down the law. I'm going to change things for the better.
Because that always ends well.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And, I mean, and, you know, and you know, the main character in my story, Raymond's like, yeah, we've heard this before. You know, they've had good intentions and they get scared by the kids and all. But he actually starts to make a bit of a difference. And he actually starts to he starts to raise the school morale as well. And so Raymond is the kid in the book who wants to be a prefect. He wants to be a school captain kind of thing, but he's a natural born loser. No one's ever going to follow him. But when he gets his chance, he tries his best to make things happen. But of course, when you try to make something happen, things always kind of fall apart or they fail as well. So it's about him trying to win the school over by doing something really wacky and crazy. So yeah, so that's going to be a whole lot of fun talking about that in August. But I'm also working on a book right now called Don't Follow V. And it's about a daughter of an Instagram mum. And her whole life from birth has been portrayed up on Instagram. And she's finally had enough of it. And she doesn't want to do it anymore kind of thing. And I've wanted to write this story for the longest time because, you've got kids these days whose life has been sort of mapped out on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And it comes to a point of, like, what happens when those kids grow up and they start their own little profile, but their mums or dads have basically put their childhood up onto the, you know, when the line get drawn.
Yeah.
And so I really wanted to sort of tackle it for the longest time, but I was really scared because as soon as you put things like Instagram or Facebook onto a book, you kind of date it. Like, you know, I cringe when I see MySpace, for example, in a book. I'm like, oh, man. But then, you know, having read books such as My Life is a Hashtag.
Yeah.
Love that book. I realized that I think it's here to stay kind of thing. Mm. So it gave me the confidence to go, okay, I need to sort of give this a go. And so that's my next book.
I've got a real thing for fiction that acknowledges the existence of the internet.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I think there's this weird thing where there's so much writing around still that just hasn't, it's like, oh, if we just ignore the internet in the world of this book, that's cool.
Yeah.
Business as usual.
Yeah. I know how you feel. And I think editors are quite reluctant to lean towards that because then they are scared of dating the book because of, like, language as well, because language just changes all the time. Like, if I put dabbing in a book, in 5 years' time, you know, kids will go, what's dabbing? What's that mean? I have to Google it up and all these kind of things. And because memes change all the time so quickly, you don't want to sort of put those in. But at the same time, you could put something in like that anyway because the kids have grown up on screens and on text and all that kind of stuff. So, but it is about finding that fine line, I think, which is
And I think it's okay for people to look stuff up too.
Absolutely. But, I think it's fine because at the same time, you know, it can't be a timeless story per se. Like you've got to still ground the kids into some sort of context.
Yeah, so in the same place, you've got to have a physical place. You have to have a place in time.
Yeah.
As well, or your book's kind of anchorless.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Oh, that sounds really fascinating, though.
Yeah. So I'm about halfway through that, and it's been a whole lot of fun actually writing that out. So,
Oh, terrific.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I think that's a really lovely note to end on. Thank you so much for talking to me, Oliver.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
6 Degrees from the City is supported by the Crown Packer Foundation, the Sydney Review of Books, and the Writing and Society Research Centre at Western Sydney University. Our theme music is by Phil Fadul, and production assistance is by Ben Denham. Thank you for listening, and see you again soon.